Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
Studies have shown that kids as young as 12 years old, you know, all this hoopla about ADD and ADHD. ADHD is a real thing. It's a little overstated and over-recorded in the U.S., but it's a real thing. But it's nothing compared to telling people that, you know, the kids are still myelinating. They're actually building their brains up to age 20, 21. And you're seeing white matter disease in children because of diet? That by far supersedes any danger of ADD, ADHD, or anything else. Because you're structurally damaging the brain that early. So we think that people shouldn't just wait till they have memory issues. They shouldn't wait till they have some stroke or vascular disease. They should assume that if we're not eating the healthy food, that you're actually affecting brain early on.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Dementia is the defining disease of our time. In the UK, it is the leading cause of death. Almost 1 million people suffer with it, and one in every 14 people in the population aged over 65. And it's growing. The most common type is Alzheimer's, and the treatment, well, there are none. And after decades of research and billions of pounds spent, we have a few drugs that mildly improve symptoms, but nothing close to a cure. And so when I came across lifestyle measures, including diet, exercise, and community-based interventions that could reduce the risk of getting dementia by 70, 80, or even some people saying 90%, I had to get Dr. Dean and Dr. Aisha Sirzai on the pod to talk about their research. They are a unique husband and wife team on the cutting edge of brain science and dedicated to educating people on the simple steps to long-term health and wellness through their work as directors of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center with patients, as well as through online writing, videos, and books at teamshirzai.com. Dr. Dean Sirzai is a behavioral neurologist and neuroscientist whose entire life has been dedicated to behavioral change models at community and population level. And Dr. Aisha Sirzai finished 2 residencies at Loma Linda University in preventative medicine and neurology. She also holds a master's in advanced sciences from UCSD and completed a fellowship in vascular neurology from Columbia University. Today's podcast is going to cover a number of different things. We talk about how they became interested in brain health and their personal reasons why they go into plant-based eating, the prevalence of dementia in the US and the UK, the brain as a huge energy and oxygen-consuming organ, and their community-based research. After today's podcast, you're going to learn a lot about creating habit loops, and why a plant-forward eating pattern is critical to preventing dementia, as well as a whole bunch of other issues as well that we see in medicine. We also talk about specific foods that Team Sherzai call out as helpful for the brain, which you'll come across. You will also learn about the issues around nutritional science and why this information is taking just so long to trickle down into clinical practice that everyone has access to. You'll learn about the main cells involved in brain health, namely the neurons and the glial cells, and just why diet, lifestyle, and other factors are becoming top of importance amongst traditional medical communities and why prevention is the cure. We go into a bit of detail about the genes known to play a role in dementia risk and how the bare minimum of those are deterministic. So if you have come across ApoE or the other genomic tests that claim to give you risk factors around Alzheimer's, you'll learn about just how much scope there is for lifestyle intervention to prevent disease as well. I'm not saying it's everything. I'm not saying, you know, it can make you your brain tip top, but it certainly has a huge impact on your risk. And we also talk about why better brain health supports your immune system and all the other parameters of how you can improve your brain health today for not only prevention, but also improved cognition, improved performance, and improved happiness as well. You can find all of this information and more in their new book, The 30-Day Alzheimer's Solution. It is a fantastic resource, as is their previous book, The Alzheimer's Solution. I've learned so much from them, and I'm sure you'll find it useful as well. For now, onto the pod. So first of all, thanks so much for making time in the morning to jump on the podcast. I wanted to kick off things because I've been following you guys for a while now. I think your work is wonderful. I wanted to ask how you started becoming interested in the brain and ultimately a plant-based way of living, because I understand, at least from what I know of Dean, that you weren't really a plant-forward eater.
Yeah, and as I said, not even close. I grew up in a family of doctors, Northeast United States, New Jersey, Pittsburgh, you know, those kind of places. As it happens, I always say this, surgeons think they're hunters. So we had a farm for hunting alone. And as it happened, thank goodness for the animals, they were horrible hunters. We would always go out the whole day trying to hunt in this huge piece of land and then come back home and go to some shop and get the meat and, you know, eat. So it was not even in my mindset to be plant-centered. And I played sports in Pittsburgh, you know, soccer, tennis, and everything else. And it was seven meals a day, even beef jerky, eating meat. And so it happened about 2002 when I went to Afghanistan, where I was asked, I was at NIH at the time doing work in building 10 experimental therapeutics branch. It's that as esoteric, as wonky and as you can get. It's the center of research, the weirdest research you can think of. And I was asked by HHS and World Bank to come to Afghanistan to help rebuild the healthcare system. So I went there. And lo and behold, in a party, this lovely person comes, sits next to me. Yes, she will. Her story is a little different, but we starts talking. And our first conversation was around our grandparents. And our first conversation was one of those events where my grandfather, who was the foundation of the family, he was the Secretary of Education, brilliant, brilliant man, poet, philosopher. He would be in the center of gathering in this farm where everybody would gather on the weekends. He would be playing chess. And on one of those occasions, and he was phenomenal in chess, he forgot how to move the knight. And for those who play chess, knight has this unusual L-shaped move, and he forgot. And everybody in the family, you know, dozens of grandchildren just in shock. Like, what's going on? And at the time, we were young, so we weren't familiar. And that was a foundational moment. And that was the moment that actually, without knowing so, pushed me towards neuro. I didn't go to general surgery. Went to neuro. Aisha experienced the same thing with her grandfather, which was a brilliant Columbia-trained, Hopkins-trained prime minister of a country who developed Alzheimer's as well.
Yeah, my grandfather was, he was, you know, one of those individuals who essentially was the hero of the family. Everybody wanted to be him. The way he spoke, the way he talked, the way he interacted with individuals. And to see a person of his stature and his intellect slowly and gradually lose parts of himself left a very deep mark on us as children. And we remember him not remembering his children's names and confusing us with strangers and being scared of us, pushing us away, locking himself into his room. And so that was quite a painful experience for our parents and for us growing up. And I was intrigued about learning what really was going on. What is dementia and how is it, you know, how does it take away yourself, your sense of existence? And so going through college, that's how I decided to get into neuroscience. And when I had that first conversation with Dean and the similarity.
But what brought you to sit next to me?
Well, of course, it was your looks and your charm and this beautiful personality. And it was an amazing
time. You'll be paid later.
he's humble about it, but Dean, he was in the experimental therapeutics branch of the NIH here in the United States. And when he went to the United States, I'm sorry, Afghanistan, he became the prime minister there. He actually changed the healthcare system he changed the healthcare system for the department or the Ministry of Health. And he created these programs for women's empowerment where, this is interesting, he actually recruited about 20,000 girls who were educated up to grade 6. And he created a nursing program for them, essentially just teaching them very basic healthcare techniques, like how to give ampicillin if somebody has upper respiratory tract infection, how to create oral rehydration solution, or how to tell the difference between spotting and bleeding if a woman is pregnant because the next tertiary care hospital was days away. And so these women became community leaders. And so there was a paradigm shift in the realm of public health. And so when you see things like that, when you make an impact like that, it's just a phenomenal way of living. And when we came back to the United States, I was there with Doctors Without Borders, just as a medical student, volunteering with them in refugee camps. And when we came back here, we went back to neurology. At the time, we went to UC San Diego. Dean started his fellowship in neurodegenerative diseases of the brain, and I did neuroimaging research in Alzheimer's disease. And it was a bleak field in Alzheimer's.
So immediately, we were a bit of a risk takers. UCSD was the number one neuroscience program in the country, and after that, the path was kind of set. You know how it is if you come from a place like that and NIH. You go to Boston and other, you know, and we said, nah, we're going to take a risk. You know, we've done the clinical trials. We've done those poor mice. We sacrificed thousands of them and looking into the hippocampus, and it wasn't getting us the result. In fact, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on brain health research and zero treatment. The treatments we have are not curative or even disease modifying. They're just symptomatic. I mean, minimally symptomatic. So we said, there's got to be a model of prevention somewhere. So we looked around. Our mentor was Elizabeth Barrett Connor, this powerful woman who had 900 publications. And we had Dilip Jeste, who was the head of NIMH, who had another 900 publications. They looked at prevention. And so we said, you know, we're going to take a risk and look. And lo and behold, about 80 miles away is Loma Linda. Loma Linda is the only blue zone. For those people who know about blue zones, these are the healthiest places in the world. And it's the only blue zone in the U.S., and it's also the only validated blue zone in the world. They have the largest study, 96,000 people over 50 years. And when we looked at the data repeatedly, lifestyle, people who lived a certain life lived 12 years more and healthier. We're not talking months. We're talking about 12 years. And we're like, wait a second, why isn't anybody talking about this? Why are we still giving, you know, molecular treatments, which we should? We're not against molecular research. It's incredibly important. But it shouldn't be 100% of the focus. It should be 20%, 30%. The other 70% should be prevention. Mm-hmm. So I, as usual, I did a cold call to president of Loma Linda. I said, I want to come and create a brain institute there. And he said, come over. We went. On the way there, our mentor, Dr. Leon Thal, who was the god of neuroscience, said, this is career suicide. And we said, it's a good death.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it's worth it. So we went there and started a clinic, started doing research. I was the director of research for all the residents, and not just neurology, and the director of research for neuroscience.
And I did a residency, dual residency in preventive medicine and neurology, just focusing on preventive neurology. So we coined the term preventive neurology, looking at the impact of lifestyle on the prevention of diseases of the brain, neurodegenerative vascular diseases of the brain.
And what we found repeatedly, I mean, without fail, was, you know, there's these food wars, you know, keto, paleo, forget about that. Whatever your food war is, there's no question that more plants work. Whatever you eat, it could be aluminum. Sorry, I don't mean to be facetious. It could be, you know, whatever it is, add more plants with it, more greens. And because the data was just overwhelming. We're talking about, Aisha went to Columbia University 2 years. I had the kids. We would fly back and forth from between New York and LA every 2 weeks. And in the morning, she would be in the ICU. At night, she would be in the cooking class. She's a culinary artist. And because what we saw repeatedly is food, food, food. And it's the dominant issue. Where whether it was stroke, California teacher study. Right.
Just looking at large databases, dietary patterns, populations being followed for a long time. We saw that people who adhered to a healthier diet had lower risk of strokes. One population that I work with is a California teacher study, 133,000 people followed for over 20 years. We wanted to find out what Mediterranean diet meant. And, you know, everybody thinks that Mediterranean diet is this diet that only exists in the Mediterranean region. But when you look at the dietary structure, you get a high score if you eat fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts and seeds. And you get a lower score if you eat processed foods and sources of saturated fats. So it's a plant predominant dietary pattern. And that was linked with reduced risk of stroke. So we kind of see this pattern over and over again.
I mean, there's so many things that I want to unpick there, because one of the things I always find fascinating is when I speak to my colleagues about the fact that I'm interested in nutrition, I'm doing a master's in nutrition, I talk about recipes and all that kind of stuff, it's met with a degree of skepticism that is, it's quite hard to overcome in an initial conversation. It's almost like I have like a set of emails that I send my colleagues afterwards, like, look at this study, you know, I get it, you know, nutritional science does have issues, it is, you know, polluted by a number of different biases, as a lot of studies are, but it is pretty undeniable when you're looking at the wealth of evidence and combining that with mechanisms that support why this might be happening, and the extension on life as well as the prevention of disease, to ignore. And so I wonder how you overcome that when you talk to other colleagues about it, and perhaps even how you overcame that yourself. I mean, it sounds like it was over a long period of time, but yourself, Dean, you know, being in a field where you're looking at pharmaceuticals, it must have been quite difficult.
The difficulty is a historical one for each individual physician. I mean, remember, we both did this. 4 years of college or 5 years in the United States and UK and Europe, it's a little different, but still that preamble. Then you have 4 years of medical school. Then you have 4 or 5 years of residency. Then we did fellowships and then, you know, master's and PhD. I mean, by the time you're out, you're so indoctrinated into a system, which is a great system. I'm not the kind that, you know, throws the baby out with the bathwater. Medical system has given us the ability to live healthfully into 70, 80 years. And for people who don't appreciate the healthcare system that we have, you know, I was the deputy minister of health in Afghanistan. I did work in Somalia and other places. 1 out of 4 children would die before the age of 5. 1 out of 6 women would die during their pregnancy. We've done amazing things with the modern medical system. So we're not saying that a modern medical system is bad. We're saying now there's time to shift a little bit towards prevention. And in the medical education, there is no prevention. The little cursory talk that says B12 deficiency or vitamin C causes scurvy.
One chapter.
Yeah, no effect because people say, oh, I don't see that in the clinic anyway. But reality is, that's the dominant issue that comes to us in the clinic after it's too late. Aisha and I live in a place where it's literally the healthiest place in the world. Right. Loma Linda, the Seventh-day Adventist, they live significantly longer and healthier than everybody else. And I mean, just that fact should tell people there is something going on that they're doing. It's not genetic, because this is not a genetically specific population. It's actually quite diverse. When you look at the Seventh-day Adventist Hispanics, when you look at the Seventh-day Adventist African-American or Blacks, and when you look at the Seventh-day Adventist Caucasian, across the board, they live longer and healthier, especially if they live plant-based. But people say, but it's not just the plant-based, they're also faith-based and they're community-driven, they walk. Yes. But when you look at the large database, when you look at the large data, that's the beauty of large data. That's why randomized clinical trials, they have their place. I led many of them at NIH and others. But they don't give you long-term data, which is extremely valuable. If I did randomized clinical trial data research in the way that it needs to be, it would be a $1 billion study, each one of them. Yeah. So they have a place, but what gives you data is large databases, because in large databases, you can parse out, through statistical models and others, parse out the confounding factors, the things that could be affecting the data, and the things that are truly the dominant issues. And when you look at this, whether it's California Teacher Study, we've been part of that, 133,000. Adventist Health Study, 96,000. The Columbia...
Northern Manhattan Study. The Women's Health Initiative.
All of them that we've been involved
Framingham
in.
Framingham Study. Yeah.
All of them, repeatedly, nutrition is the dominant issue.
Right. And when you see this information coming at you from different lines of studies, whether it's observational studies, different epidemiological studies, in clinical trials as well, I think, you know, even if there are one or two papers that point towards the other direction, but the majority actually have, you know, pointing more towards a healthful living and nutrition being a very important factor, that's where you move. And that's how science works. There are no absolutes in science. You just look at the majority of the data and see where it points and you follow.
And with the physicians, that's beautifully stated, absolutely. And with the physicians, the second impediment is there is this sense of incredulity, lack of belief that things can be done, because a physician has 15 minutes with a patient in the United States. In that 15 minutes, I'm lucky to listen to the heart, tap the knee in my case. We don't listen to the heart. Who listens to the heart? Neurologists don't listen to the heart. Yeah. You don't even have a heart.
Nothing from down here. Yeah. No, yeah. I'm kidding.
I tap the glabella. I do
don't
the eye
movement. Don't say that. My supervisor.
I'm joking. I do that complete exam head to toe in 15 minutes and give a full advice. No, but all of that, and then believe that I can say something that can truly change people. Well, they're right. In that 15 minutes, it can't be done. But where it can be done is in the conversations that we can have in the communities. That's why very early on, we went to the communities. We actually currently lead the largest community-based brain health initiative in the country. The reason I put the community-based part, my PhD is in community-based participatory research. The community-based part, there are studies out there, the pointer and others, that they do clinical work on nutrition and lifestyle, but I think that's contrived. We actually go to the communities, use the resources of the communities, have conversations with the communities, and then bring about lifestyle change in these communities. But when do we have that time in our clinical setting? Mm. Or ironically and fortuitously, what you do in your clinical setting and in the social media and what we do in social media has been more effective than what I've done in 1,000 clinic visits.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially if we stand for science, especially if we make the hard have the hard conversation saying that, you know, this little gimmick thing, lectin, is popular, but the science is this. And have the hard conversations. You get bashed, you get put down. With us going fully plant-based, if we had not gone plant-based, the fact that we did the largest study in the country, in the world, the fact that we've published papers, the fact that we said, this is the data. Now, how we change individuals or help, we won't change them. How we create the conversations that they can create environments in their own home is by meeting them where they are, not giving dictations and edicts from up above. Here's a prescription, 20 broccolis. I've said that before. No, I haven't said that. So you have to meet people where they are, and everybody's in different stages of journey. And that humility is had when I look at myself 20 years ago, where my diet was, you know, meat, processed food, and cupcakes, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and a 5 or 6 Cokes, you know, soft drinks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I thought that was healthy, dude, because I was running around. So I can't be arrogant about where people should be. We just have to meet them, and give one tool at a time.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm really interested in your personal journey there, actually, because, you know,
was it the cupcakes?
When I transitioned cupcakes.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I mean, where do the 5 Cokes come from? I don't know where. Yeah, that. I mean, that's pretty shocking. But I mean, you know, that aside, I think it's very difficult for people to change behavior. And I'm wondering what your personal experience has led to in terms of how you encourage and empower other people to make the changes that you ultimately made as well. And also, you know, you talk about in your book about mimicking the savory tastes and the what you might miss as well from a diet that has a lot more refined products in, sugar sweetened products and meat products as well. So I wonder how you came across that yourselves.
Yeah, I think the first step, and I know you do this all the time too, Rupi, is to find out why. Why is it that someone or some people have a particular type of a habit? Conversations and listening and understanding people's situation helps quite a lot instead of coming from a place where you're trying to quote unquote fix things. Being a fixer never works in the realm of behavioral neurology or behavior in general. So understanding why, finding out patterns of behavior specifically, going down into the details. I mean, we even have questionnaires and checklists to find out what they do the first thing they wake up in the morning. What do they eat? What do they have inclinations towards when they're under stress? What kind of foods do they move towards? And why is it that healthy habits don't happen around them? And then obviously it's different for different people. And finding out one element that they can change at a time. Dean always brings his business background into this and creates SMART goals, you know, specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound goals. And that works in many cases because it seems easy. People are busy. The notion that you are working towards a better health is difficult to maintain because sometimes you don't see immediate effects. And especially when it comes to brain health, you don't see better focus and attention, you know, minutes right away. It's not like a cream you put on your skin and you see that your skin is getting moisturized and it looks better. Yeah. So yeah. Conversations, education, finding out what works for them, coming from their perspective, and making sure that you earn their trust, that they don't think that you're sitting from a very elitist position, you know, speaking down to them and telling them what to do because you're the know-all. That never works. Mm. And so that's why we're very passionate about our Healthy Minds Initiative, which is the non-for-profit organization, and everything we do go towards that. And yeah. we go out into communities to have conversations and to essentially find out people who can be health ambassadors or brain health ambassadors and speak to individuals and spread this message of hope and empowerment.
Beautifully. One of the things about human brain is it's a 3-pound organ, 2 pounds. It's a jello. It's a hard jello. If anybody's ever held a brain in their hand, and I hope that if you did, you were a physician and it wasn't in condition. Yeah.
That would be gruesome if,
I know,
if
I know.
It was otherwise.
So I'm not speaking to those people. But in general, it's 3 pounds, 2%, but consumes 25% of your body's energy at any one point. It can even more at times. Oxygen as much as 50% at times. It does some of its best work during sleep, which should be a clue. Sleep is extremely important. Restorative sleep, we call it. But this brain, this amazing brain, needs low energy outputs. No low energy behaviors. And another name for low energy behaviors is habits. So we develop these habit loops. For computer scientists out there, there are these macro loops. These are programs that set and repeat themselves. Well, that's literally what a habit loop is. It's a macro loop program. And 90%, if not more, arbitrary number. I hate arbitrary numbers, but sometimes you have to use them. It stands for a lot. A lot of your behavior, even your political views, are habit loops that are set early on in life. They're connected to other habit loops. That's why they're hard to change, because they're interconnected habit loops. Now, these habit loops are, that people quote, places like the basal ganglia, but it's mostly driven in basal ganglia, but other places as well. But these habit loops are well ingrained. They were functional. Even when they were dysfunctional, they were functional. Because if they were doing something bad, they were serving some psychological need, a bad psychological need somewhere else. So they were functional. To change that, by the way, most of your habit loops are set in your teenage years. And I tell people, really, you want to stick to your teenage habits? I have two teenagers at home. I love them. They're phenomenal. But those are not the habit loops you want. So, so resetting the habit loops is critical. So teaching people, instead of all, so I gave some jargon here, but saying, what if I can tell you that we can change habits, and habits are critical because they can give you the kind of power that marshals the full capacity of this brain that's got trillions of connections and 1 × 10^50 processing power. More powerful than any supercomputer today. And we just use it to watch Big Brother or some other show. You know, it's incredible power. But if we control the habit loops, and the habit loops are changed one small behavior at a time. In fact, throw away the New Year resolution. Throw away the new diet. Forget about the name, whatever name you've heard, one habit, a specific, measurable, and attainable habit. So let's say that you look at your life and you say, my diet is not good. That's not helpful. That actually creates more anxiety, which pulls you away, you know, the fight or flight. How about you say, you know, sugar, we all agree on sugar. Sugar's bad. That's one thing people don't argue about, but let's say sugar's bad. Okay, first quantify it, truly, because we underestimate how much we consume. How much of the processed sugar you're getting in your canned foods and your packaged foods or added sugar. I'm going to reduce that, or in white bread and things like that. I'm going to reduce that by 50%. First, be honest with yourself. Is that doable? 50% of, and it shouldn't be just elimination. How are you going to replace it with something else that's, if not equal, at least satiates that need for a little bit? So sugar, 50%, and here's the replacement for the next 2 months. By the way, sugar is as powerful as cocaine. You need 2 months. 21 days is not going to do it. 2 months. So sugar. And once you succeed on that one little, by the way, have a little box where you check it off on a daily basis. You change that one behavior specifically, measurably, visibly. And after 2 months, you've actually gone through the withdrawal. Yes, you'll actually feel bad first. Because all change feels bad. All change from high energy, high processed food feel bad because it's taking away that overdrive. So you're going to feel bad. You're going to feel the withdrawal. And then when you settle to your resting state, even that sugar, what do we get every time? The fog has lifted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
So one habit specifically, measurably, will change. Well, it will be the nidus for the beginning of a pattern, not on diet, not on exercise, but on a control over your habit creation. That's where, you know, the name of the book is The 30-Day Alzheimer's Solution. But it's not about, you know, we were uncomfortable. We are uncomfortable with every gimmick.
Yeah.
From process to GMO to, but even 30 days. But the 30 days is not going to give you beginning of a new life by no stretch. But the goal of that 30 days is to get control of habit creation. And knowing that changing diet is not deprivation. It cannot be deprivation. It fails. Changing diet is small incremental successes toward a more variety of beautiful, plentiful, vibrant life that doesn't break your brain, but makes your brain. We say that every food you eat, every meal, either breaks your brain a little bit or makes your brain a little bit. So that's the habit change pathway that we undertake.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that really do speak to me about that. It really does remind me about the TED Talk that I was privileged to give in Bristol, where we started our culinary medicine program at the medical school there. And I talked about the diet wars and how actually when you look at them, 80% probably agree on things, and it's getting rid of processed foods, sugar, poor quality fats, et cetera, et cetera. And really what you want to be focusing on are the habits that you can make every single day that compound over time to lead to a healthier diet that you can sustain? Because the biggest thing that I find, particularly when I talk to people about the way I like to eat, is, well, that's completely far removed from the way I eat right now. That's completely unattainable for me. But the way you've explained it in terms of just making one change at a time, I think it's super important. And that's exactly how I like to bring it up, particularly in our clinic appointments, which are around 8 to 10 minutes in the UK here.
Yeah.
We're really, really stretched as well. We're talking about the brain today, and I love the way you talked about the brain being a largely lipid organ, very energy consuming as well. I wonder if you can give us a sort of insight into the degree by which dementia is affecting the population in the US. I know in the UK it's the leading cause of death. About 1 in 14 people in the UK actually suffer with dementia over the age of 65. It's definitely a growing issue. I'm assuming it's similar in the US.
Oh, definitely. It's the numbers are very scary. Currently, around 6 million people are living with dementia in the United States.
Wow.
This number is increasing. And we think that this is an underestimation of the true numbers, because there are a lot of communities and a lot of populations who never report it. And it is considered as a normal part of aging to have memory problems. So we think it's an underestimation. And the numbers, 1 in 10 over the age of 65 has dementia. And this number actually increases quite a bit until about age 85, where almost 50% of the population have dementia. It is the costliest disease. It's the total numbers, the annual cost in 2020 was $305 billion, but that was just the direct cost. There's another $250 billion indirect cost, where caregivers and loved ones take care of their family members and they lose a lot of days at work and things of that nature. So it is the costliest disease. And in itself, it's going to break down our system. Forget about healthcare system. So everybody needs to talk about it at this point. And right now, with 400 clinical trials being done, no treatment for it at all, not a single medicine that can actually modify the disease. We have nothing. The couple of medications that are out there in the market, they are only for symptoms. And they don't work for a very long time, only months to about a year. And the burden on the patients and on their loved ones is immense. And it is projected that by 2050, if we continue to go through this, trajectory, the cost is going to be astronomical, $1.3 trillion. And so we all have to talk about this. And
definitely,
it has to be a big part of the conversation, whether it's our politics or our healthcare system.
And the important point here is, as Aisha pointed out, is that much of it can be prevented. Whereas that concept was controversial just a few years ago. We've been talking about prevention for the last nearly 8 to 10 years. And initially, when we were talking about this, we wouldn't even get invited to certain conferences. 2 years ago, Alzheimer's Association International Conference, 5,000 dementia neurologists from around the world, the plenary talk was prevention is the new cure. Aisha and I were like jumping up and down, like, okay, now it's popular.
Yeah, the first slide was prevention is the new treatment.
Yeah.
But it took a long time to come to that point.
Exactly. And even then, they said 60% can be prevented. We think that with optimal is hard, with optimal diet, exercise, stress management, sleep, and mental activity, the five pillars that we've named, neuro, N-E-U-R-O, nutrition, exercise, unwind, with those five pillars optimally, and again, we say it's hard, up to 90% of dementia, the most costliest disease, up to 80 to 90% of strokes, Aisha's specialty, strokes, all, and stroke is another the most debilitating of all diseases, can be prevented. And there's no question of that. Yet, like you said earlier, it's difficult to sell this in the physical, in the clinical world, because what is required to create the preventive pathway is conversations, listening, time, looking at communities, and how can we do that in 8 to 15 minute increments.
Yeah,
it's impossible.
Exactly.
So now physicians are good people. Let's just say that. We're good people, right? So
We're good people.
We are.
We are good people.
Yeah. And we want to be, most of us, if not all of us, went into this to make a difference. Both of us, because of our families, we saw the good they did and everything. And when you hear the kind of things that you have no access to, and it claims to do massive things, the dissonance it creates inside, you have to create language against dissonance. This is human nature. We have two things: confirmation bias, where we confirm the biases we had before, and creating language to get rid of the dissonance. So these good physicians that want to do good hear things that say that your work is not as effective as if you did public health and spoke to people like you'd be doing. It creates such dissonance that you have to create language that says, no, that can't be. It's not true. Mm. But the data is just overwhelming. The data is not questionable. We've done 5 reviews now, massive reviews. In fact, actually 7. We just submitted 2 reviews, comprehensive reviews, one on omega-3 and the developing brain and omega-3 and the aging brain. And repeatedly, the breadth and the force of data that shows that nutrition, especially a clean diet, plant-based diet, but the reason that I say plant-based, because I'm not running away from vegan, I'm not running away from this or that. It's just, if we can change the diet of UK, Europe, United States, even 20% to more plant-based, that's 20% or so cost saving in healthcare. We're talking about trillions of dollars. So we can't be dogmatic. Let's move more plant-based. Let's go more cleaner. Let's go less processed. And if you're going to have cupcakes, have healthy cupcakes. So, yeah.
Rupee's cupcakes.
Rupee's cupcakes, yeah.
my cupcakes, yeah. I'm not a very good baker, I'll be honest. But, you know, I'm glad you brought up these numbers, because these are the things that I wanted to ask you about. When you're looking at the magnitude of dementia in the US and the UK, when you look at the cost of it as well, and you have a potential program that has a 90% disease reduction or thereabouts, you know, you'd think healthcare systems would be jumping at the opportunity to employ this by any means necessary, because whatever it takes, whether it's medical meals, whether it's personalized nutritionists, whether it's changing the food landscape to make the right sorts of foods cheaper, we would be employing right now. So there is still a barrier there. Where it's coming from, I'm not too sure. And I think, you know, the fact that you talk about the plenary session starting off with prevention, I think it's great, but that often takes a long time to trickle down into practice, isn't it?
So you have to look at where the impediments are. So the impediments are information, resources, and real estate, it's about location, location, location. In public health, it's access, access, access. Access to information, access to resources, and access to healthcare. Access to information, the healthcare system doesn't have the mechanism or the will to say that we are not doing the thing at the disease. So healthcare system that we have now is fantastic, but it's disease care. We meet patients at the point of disease. Those well checks are really not doing anything. You should go to your well checks. I'm not saying, but they're not really designed to do prevention. They're designed to actually check the beginnings of disease. Yeah. So the healthcare system doesn't have access to how to bring the information to the public. That's one impediment. And the culture change is so massive that it's better to ignore it than to meet that culture change. Culture is when language around the concept becomes ubiquitous in populations. So that's a problem. The second access point is, who's funding this as far as information? Let's just take information and research. The funding comes from resources. I was at NIH. We actually doled out the funding. You know, $27 billion was the funding at the time that they gave out. And and the only way that a group of scientists would give money to another group of scientists is if you could measure the outcome tangibly. Like the sodium level, no, the glucose level, or let's say the hemoglobin A1C level went from 6.4 to 6.2. That's a good study. That's not how public health works. You can't get that kind of measurements. you have to move populations and have different kind of measurements, which means against culture difference and a method of funding difference. So lo and behold, they said, okay, lifestyle works. Let's give it funding, millions of dollars. And again, now they're bringing patients to clinics to give them dietary advice. My PhD thesis was community-based participatory research. And we looked at African-American communities or Black communities, sorry, Hispanic communities and other communities. The possibility of transferring that information to the clinic did not exist. You have to go to the communities, to the faith communities, to the churches, to the barbershops and other places, because that's where transfer of information takes place. Now, if I bring that level of complexity, oh my God, a whole hoopla. Really? But that's what has to happen. So the questionnaires that are being applied in research were created in the 1960s, 70s on 50-year-old white men in Boston. The most educated. So, and now we were applying those in 70-year-old Hispanic women in San Bernardino. Yeah. And when it didn't connect, we said, oh, it's failure. The failure is not in the person. The failure is not in the process. The failure is in the tools we're using from antiquated beliefs, antiquated thoughts, antiquated processes. So what we did in our research, we actually went to the communities. It's called CBPR. You sit down with community leaders. But it's not unstructured. So people say, oh, but no, it's structured. You give questions. And we got questions that were relevant to that community. We created a questionnaire out of that, then applied the questionnaire. And what we got was 180 degrees different from what had been coming to us before. And that's different than our other study, which is the largest study in beach cities, where it's an affluent population. It's mostly a Caucasian population. So it's a different kind of community. And we got different responses. And Africa and Black churches, we got different kind of... So the impediment is in a mindset that comes to us from 1950s, which is the solid box mindset, not the amorphous complexity, beauty of complexity. And then the other impediment is the sources of funding, which is the research, which says, give me one solid outcome.
Yeah.
You know, and it's got to be sodium of this or potassium of this. And human behavior is not about that one solid number. Now, we can give you numbers that are movable, tangible, operational, but not the way that it worked 50 years ago. So that's where I see the impediment. That's why conversations that you and I and Aisha and at Columbia and others, where it's a little uncomfortable, you push people and say, research has to adapt a little.
Yeah, absolutely. It is really uncomfortable to have these conversations because we're very used to that model of experimentation such that we can see robust results. It's, you know, the pharmaceutical model of healthcare, which is brilliant. And, you know, like we've said on this podcast, is something that we prescribe every day and me in clinic and all the rest of it. But when it applies to nutrition and behavior change, that are sustainable over long periods of time doesn't really have the same outcomes or doesn't have the same weight when it's applied to that that mode of medicine. I wanted to dive in a bit deeper into the nature of how you came up with certain ingredients like the Neuro9, which I love, by the way. And I love all the different sort of names, like the Neuro abbreviation as well. But the Neuro9, I'm specifically interested in how you came across these sets of ingredients and why these are so beneficial from the perspective of the brain and cardiovascular disease.
Oh, well, thank you. We were actually initially a little uncomfortable to come up with, you know, these little quips and lists, but I think it's a fun way for people to remember. And again, that comes from our experience of working in communities to say, okay, you know, at the end of a very complex conversation, you know, people usually tell us like, doc, just tell me what to eat. Okay. What can I eat every day? Right. So, you know, from a very complex place, then you have to like really pinpoint some things. Okay, here's what you can do tomorrow, or here's what you can do today. And the Neuro9 came up from just looking at dietary patterns, whether it was the Mediterranean diet or the MIND diet, which is a combination of the Mediterranean and the DASH diet. and, you know, a whole food plant-based diet that has been studied in the Adventist Health Study. And, you know, although we shy away from the concept of reductionism in nutrition, and I don't like the word superfood, there is no such thing, but, you know, these foods essentially stand out when it comes to their anti-inflammatory and antioxidant capacities. And when you look at dietary inflammatory indices, they kind of stand there on top. So we chose the first nine ones because, you know, Neuro 9, and of course it's greens, beans, blueberries, because they've been studied extensively as far as their benefits for brain health is concerned, nuts and seeds, whole grains. And we're happy that we included whole grains there because there's a war against whole grains. Goodness gracious, all that fiber is phenomenal. And green tea. So I think I'm forgetting it, right? That's a very bad sign.
No, that's
things.
Good. That you
right,
got it.
So
you got it, yeah.
Herbs and spices. And so we included that. And what we say is, you know, see if you can include any of these in your daily diet. You know, it's not an all or none phenomenon. It's not black and white. You can slowly and gradually add things to your diet to make it even healthy. And we've included all of these Neuro 9 items in the recipes in the book.
The main thing about the mechanism actually was the driver. So the mechanisms of disease, especially, I mean, for cognition, for brain diseases, there seems to be four pathways. If we would have followed our scientific gut, we couldn't have written the book, because we hate reducing things into because it's more complex. But nonetheless, four main processes: inflammation, oxidation, glucose or energy dysregulation, and lipid dysregulation. And when you look at the genetics of Alzheimer's, through these amazing techniques, GWAS analysis, which is genome-wide analysis, and others, we now know about 30 genes or more that are associated with Alzheimer's. Only 3% of Alzheimer's is driven by the kind of genes that are what we call 100% penetrance, meaning that if you have these genes, you're going to get the disease no matter what. 3%. What about the other 97%? Well, the other 97% are affected by genes, yes, but it's not a foregone conclusion. The genes have an interplay with lifestyle. In fact, those genes are directly lifestyle related. The second highest risk gene is APOE4, to be exact, APOE4. If you have one gene from one parent, your risk goes up 4 times. If you have one gene from, or one from each parent, your risk goes up 12 times. By the way, only 2% of population in the U.S. have two genes, APOE4. So you would think that if you have two genes, you're going to get the disease, right? No, 50% never develop the disease. Why? Lifestyle. Why? Because APOE4 is not an Alzheimer's gene. APOE4 is a lipid transport inflammatory gene, which means that if you have APOE2, the protein or the protein that it creates is a pretty efficient protein. It transports lipids very well. It has its anti-inflammatory very well. In fact, it protects you against Alzheimer's. But if you have APOE4, it's a bad gene. It's not doing its job well. So you actually are more easily succumb to the disease. So there's a joke from Henny Youngman, very old comedian: "Doctor, it hurts when I do this." And the answer is, don't do that, you know?
Don't do that,
yeah. So, doctor, I have a risk for Alzheimer's and stroke if I eat lipids. Well, don't eat saturated fats and trans fats. So that's literally what it is. If you have risk, or if you think you have risk, or if you just want to reduce risk, the things that become problematic, which is lipid transport, reduce the bad lipids. And there's good lipids and bad lipids. We want to make sure we don't exaggerate the good lipids so that people eat too much of even the good lipids. Glucose dysregulation. You know, glucose dysregulation is affected by lipids mostly, but even by sugar and processed sugars. Well, don't eat processed sugars. Doctor, I have a risk of developing diabetes. We did a study on NHANES, one of the largest databases. We actually excluded diabetics and looked at pre-diabetics, insulin resistance. Even with uncontrolled pre-diabetics, insulin, they had lower cognitive state. That's not meant to scare you. That's meant to empower you, because glucose dysregulation can be affected through diet powerfully.
And it also points to the the disease as a spectrum. People think that when they start having Alzheimer's disease, it's all of a sudden. But we know that these processes actually start happening in our bodies and in our brains decades before the symptoms manifest and the brain loses its resilience and kind of gives up and the brain cells are damaged to the point where people tend to have memory problems. So, you know, knowing that anything and everything we do every single day actually contributes to that pathological process or gives the brain the right environment to grow and heal itself and to thrive, I think that's quite empowering.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on lipids there, and I wanted to talk about fat in the brain, because I think there is a new sort of pervasive idea that because the brain is largely made up of fat, that we can somehow eat tons of fat and it will go straight to our brain. I know you guys both as physicians know that that's not quite what happens, and there's no storage capacity for the brain as well, which I think a lot of people need to understand. So, but what is this delicate relationship between fats in our brain and fats in our diet?
Yeah, thank you for bringing this up, because it is a big misunderstanding. So yes, the brain is a fatty organ. It has a lot of fat. I think that has been exaggerated. People say it's 70% fat, but when you look at the calculations, that includes the water content as well. So it's much lower than that. But the fat in the brain is all structural fat. So it's a part and parcel of the wall of the cell, the structures of the neurons and the glial cells and the dendrites and the axons. And it's, you know, you don't have storage fat in the brain, which is a brilliant evolutionary concept, because imagine what would happen to the brain if we went into starvation mode, right? It would start eating up itself. That doesn't happen. So the only kind of fats that the brain needs on a regular basis are omega-3 fatty acids. And they're small enough to go through the blood-brain barrier. So the blood-brain barrier is a very tight junction. And it's like, you know, like security guards at the brain that don't really allow a lot of things to go in. That's why, you know, infections and bigger, larger molecules are not allowed to pass through the blood vessels into the brain. And so omega-3 passes through and we need it on a daily basis. But as far as saturated fat is concerned or cholesterol is concerned, it doesn't. The cholesterol that our body produces in the liver is enough to add to the structural organization of the brain, and we don't need to consume more of it. As a matter of fact, if we consume too much saturated fat, the very intricate blood vessels, which we have millions and millions of tributaries of these blood vessels in the brain, they get damaged. We have very sensitive layers of endothelium in these arteries that get damaged with too much saturated fats and trans fatty acids. And there was a time when Alzheimer's disease specifically was considered as a disease that essentially was related to abnormal protein deposition in the brain. But we now know that there is a lot of overlap between vascular disease and Alzheimer's too. So the damage to these small little sensitive arteries can actually cause damage to very susceptible areas of the brain, including the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain related to memory encoding, the frontal lobe. And we see these small little tiny strokes without any manifestations like paralysis of one side of the body or loss of speech or blindness. The small vascular damage to the brain actually tends to increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease too. So it's very important from a public health perspective for people to know that you don't need to eat a lot of saturated or fat in general, and especially no need for eating saturated fats and trans fatty acids, because it can damage the vasculature in the brain.
One of the things that we are seeing, and we're writing something about this now, which is not recorded as a, in the United States, we have these codes that you record the disease, ICD-10 now. It was ICD-9, ICD-10. UK, you have codes as well. There is no code for mild to moderate white matter disease. Nobody records it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you don't record that.
Okay.
But given that both of us see patients older than 55, almost exclusively, right. Except I see some athletes as well who come from traumatic brain injury. But we see the prevalence of white matter disease ubiquitous.
Oh, my goodness.
Present.
Always.
And it's directly related to diet, to their lipid levels or hemoglobin A1C levels. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, to know that you are seeing white matter disease. And by the way, if you're seeing little dots, a few of them, it doesn't mean that it's nothing. They say that whenever you see anything on the MRI, multiply it 10,000 times at the molecular level and throughout the brain, because you're not seeing it fully manifest, but it's there. So that to me is the biggest epidemic in the West, a thing that we're not even recording, the thing that's actually behind the fog, the thing that's behind the cognitive decline that starts early, but not to the extent where a person is calling themselves demented or a mild cognitive impairment. It's the beginnings of it. So if we can reverse that, and we know we can reverse that through diet and lifestyle, exercise and everything else, we will have done more than any other public health endeavor. But here's the thing. Studies have shown that kids as young as 12 years old, you know, all this hoopla about ADD and ADHD, ADHD is a real thing. It's a little overstated and over-recorded in the US, but it's a real thing. But it's nothing compared to telling people that, you know, the kids are still myelinating. They're actually building their brains up to age 20, 21. And you're seeing white matter disease in children because of diet? That by far supersedes any danger of ADD, ADHD, or anything else. Because you're structurally damaging the brain that early. So we think that people shouldn't just wait till they have memory issues. They shouldn't wait till they have some stroke or vascular disease. They should assume that if we're not eating the healthy food, that you're actually affecting brain early on. Now, this is not a scare tactic. Again, I repeat this not just for sake of perseveration, but for sake of empowerment. Every meal that we choose to eat a healthy, tasty, by the way, this is not me being obsequious to what you do or what Aisha does. I have to be obsequious to Aisha. She's my wife. But it's truly meant that when people teach people how to make healthy, tasty, easy foods, that's by far the most important public health tool we're giving. Because every meal is either creating inflammation, oxidation, glucose dysregulation, or lipid dysregulation, or it's the opposite. So the Neuro9, coming back to that, it's not a magic phenomenon. We hate doing these kind of gimmick things. But it's the idea of that they have the highest anti-inflammatory index, antioxidant index, as far as glucose and lipid dysregulation, because they have high fiber and low glycemic index and everything else. These foods, when added to your diet on a daily basis, you only have so much stomach space. If you're eating more greens, which take a lot of space, it leaves less space for the donuts, hopefully. Yeah. And that replacement is a 180 degrees change in direction. So that was the point of the Neuro9 and Aisha's work and creating recipes around that, basically.
I think it's really interesting because the formation of, you know, call it whatever you like, a list of foods that you put together to inform people really has its foundation in the processes that you just talked about, glucose regulation, managing inflammation that I want to go back to now. And I think one of the best things about the book was the NeuroPlan spectrum. And for those of you who aren't watching, it's the spectrum of food by which, you know, you can sort of concentrate, you can visually see where you should be concentrating your diet towards. And it's things that we've mentioned, beans, nuts, legumes, etc. And you know, the things that we should be having less of or not at all in the diet as well. So I think from, you know, from the perspective of habitual change, it can be quite useful, particularly when it's underpinned with that explanation. And I wanted to go back to one of the points of difference, I think, between yourselves and perhaps some other physicians that are fully plant-based like yourselves is the judicious use of extra virgin olive oil. Mm-hmm. Some people say you shouldn't be having any oil on your diet whatsoever, whereas you're a little bit more moderate with olive oil. I wonder if you could explain the difference between yourselves.
Yeah. Well, honestly, one of our favorite statements is, to the best of our knowledge today, we go by the data. And if tomorrow the data comes against what we've been following for years, we're going to be honest about it and say, well, you know, it has changed now. We're going to change too. And when you look at olive oil, there really isn't any data of it being damaging. As a matter of fact, it's beneficial. Especially when it comes to switching from a source of saturated fats to extra virgin olive oil, which is a source of mono and polyunsaturated fats. And like we were talking about it earlier, yeah, fats are important for the brain. It's the quality and the source that matters the most. So we're not against olive oil. We used to be very judicious about it, but then after reading about it, and right now Dean and I are doing a systematic review on consumption of extra virgin olive oil and prevention of Alzheimer's disease and stroke. And the data is quite profound as far as its protective effects are concerned.
Nutrition data is never going to be, well, never, as you know, with AI, who knows? But it's going to take some time for it to be perfect data. But again, we say we look at massive trends. A massive data. The data against it comes from vasoconstriction studies. And even then, it was not the best studies because it didn't take into account when they took it, how much they took, and other factors that were related to the vasoconstriction. And the fact that some of the things that we definitely know are healthy, when they did the vasoconstriction studies with it, they actually vasoconstricted. So to look at a food item in isolation of everything else and with one little sliver of a window of data, I think is not helpful.
Yeah.
Now, we're not going to go all out and say extra virgin olive oil is the new panacea. It's not. It's not.
Yeah.
I told one of my patients that they can take extra virgin olive oil, and he came back with a bottle of extra virgin olive oil a month later. I said, why did you bring this? He said, oh, I have three glasses of this a day. I can assure you. Yeah. Yeah. I can assure you there's a quantitative component as well. We always say in small amounts to the best of our knowledge right now, you know, as a topper as opposed to the bottom, you know, you don't...
Drizzle it on salad.
Yeah. and that's helpful. But beyond that, so that's where the data is right now.
Right.
And we go by the data. And then the other component is public health. If I go to some of the communities that we're working in, and we say the data shows whole food plant-based, we say that. But where you should be is not even close to that. You should be sugar for the next 2 months. That's it. And then the next thing, as you can do it, as these resources allow themselves. And it has to be that way. Otherwise, all we're doing is just pushing our books and being part of clans. And the last time we knew, we've had a pretty interesting life being in NIH and Afghanistan 2 months apart. We just want to go with data and what people can bring into their lives.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, it comes back to that idea of meeting people where they're at, rather than trying to push that what could be perceived as an agenda without really appreciating what the ultimate aim is. And that's just to help people live as healthy as they can and as healthy as they want to as well. I wonder if we could touch on inflammation in the brain, actually, because there's a lot of people who are now coming around to the idea about neuroinflammation and how that impacts not just memory and concentration, but also mental well-being as well. And also specifically how it relates to sugar and perhaps some other components of fast food.
So inflammation seems to be the common downstream pathway of a lot of other processes. And I mean, if you look at glucose dysregulation or lipid dysregulation, downstream, you're going to have inflammation. Or not even downstream, almost like parallel at times, but it's not usually parallel. So you see inflammation. So inflammation is a major denominator of pathology. In some diseases, it's the main pathology. For example, traumatic brain injury, it's the thing that pushes the disease over the edge, inflammation. And now, where we're working, we're hoping to start a study. Although the IRB is taking its time, but they have these ligands that bind to inflammatory products in the brain. So you actually look at neuroinflammation in real life. So that would be amazing thing.
Neuroimaging study. Yes.
So you can actually look at when you give somebody certain foods to see what the inflammatory process going on in the brain. It's a beginning.
Really?
At the beginning stages of the research. So I don't want to overstate it, but it's pretty exciting. Sure. It's extremely exciting.
Yeah.
So we know that all those processes, that the common pathway downstream is inflammation. Be it if you have insulin resistance or diabetes that's uncontrolled, definitely that's a path that leads to it. Or as I was talking about before, even ApoE4 and lipids. One of the pathways, lipid deposition, yes, atherosclerosis, clogging, and even, but the other more common and ubiquitous is inflammation as a product. So inflammation is a major component. Now, ironically, people who have autoimmune diseases, who have inflammation, studies have shown that if they've been on anti-inflammatory drugs, they actually did better. But then when they tried to reproduce it, it never came to fruition. So what's a good anti-inflammatory that you can take on a daily basis? Again, I'm coming. It seems to come back. It's food. It
ties
it's
everything food. Together, yeah. Food. Doesn't it?
Yeah. And then the other thing is exercise.
Yeah.
Exercise seems to be a very powerful, I hate another general term, cleansing, because again, all these cleansing things. But it seems to be a great system of flushing and cleansing, as well as direct inflammatory reduction as well. So ironically, we're talking about food. When it comes to behavior change, because it has an immediate psychological, immediate physiological response, exercise is the thing that we actually start people first. And if they've never exercised, a 10-minute brisk walk every morning is what we start with. And that 10-minute brisk walk, it resets the circadian clock as much as we can. It gets the metabolism going. It gets the habit of exercise. And also, it is mood stabilizer. We know that exercise is three times more beneficial than any anti-anxiety medicine. So exercise is a powerful adjunct to food as a medicine.
And I think it's that multifactorial, comprehensive approach to health that makes the biggest difference. You know, Dean talked about exercise. We now know that sleep, when we sleep, that's the most important period of the day when the brain cleanses itself, when all these, debris and the byproducts are essentially removed from the brain. We have a janitorial system in our brain that is completely dedicated to getting rid of all of these byproducts that eventually could lead to inflammation and damage to the brain.
Yeah, because I think another thing that perhaps I've been guilty of in the past is just really thinking about the brain through the lens of neurons, whereas actually there are some really important cells that are just as important, like the microglia and your astrocytes and all those various functions. I wonder, is there some data that shows how food impacts those as much as the neurons directly themselves?
I would say even more, because by just sheer numbers more, because when you take the glia, the whole family of glia, they outnumber the neurons 10 to 1, 9 to 1 to 10 to 1, depending on what series you look at. They are structural. They're your immune response in the brain. They're your anti-inflammatory response to the brain. They're the support structures. They're the things that actually connect the neurons. They're the things that actually wrap up and protect the neurons. These glia are the hardest working cells. I mean, I know that the GI docs will disagree with me, but they are incredibly hardworking. And they're also high energy structures, be it from their mitochondria and everything else. And there's data that the cells that get damaged first are the glial cells. And remember, they're multifactorial, multifunction because of their immune response, their cleansing and all that. When the glia are affected, the entire system goes awry. You know, in the hospital, we think that we run the hospital, the doctors. Not even close. It's the nurses. It's the, you know, the people that manage the system, administrators and all of that.
They're amazing.
So if doctors go away, the nurses can take care of the hospital. It will still run, I can assure you.
Yeah.
But if the nurses and the administrators and all of those are affected, the hospital is gone. And the glial cells are profoundly affected. I think there's data that they are affected even earlier. And their effect is a cascade phenomenon, meaning that when one series is affected, others are affected as well. So I would say to people, yeah, we're proud of our neurons, but those glial cells are who we are. They contain us. Like, for example, we think about the rest of our bodies, but those microbacteria in our gut, they're actually outnumbering us and they're doing an amazing work. So,
I want to come back to actually the immune system and how that impacts how the brain impacts the immune system and vice versa as well. But one thing you mentioned there about exercise is its ability to remove toxins, and you didn't shy away in either of your books about the potential negative impacts of meat and fish products. And this kind of comes back to my sort of in the spirit of vulnerability, my confirmation bias about wanting to eat some fish in my diet. And I look at the studies, we're like, actually, yeah, there's an association between fish consumption and vegetables and, you know, lower rates of disease and lower rates of dementia. So I'm more inclined to rest on that data rather than the wealth of data that you guys might be talking about, because I inherently want to enjoy my grilled sardines.
Yes.
But, you know, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the potential negative impacts of meat and fish.
So here's a shocking piece of information. We have communities that support us. At a time where our book is coming out next month, we're going to say something that's next week. It's very controversial, but it's not actually. So here's the transparency. We're vegans, healthy vegans, because it can be unhealthy vegans quite a bit. So we are healthy vegans for three reasons: environment, animals, and science of nutrition. So as it happens, we're so glad that the three Venn diagrams superimpose. But the data on fish, you're right. The data on fish is there's no negative data at this point, especially fatty fish. We call SMASH, salmon, mackerel, anchovies, you know, so... we don't choose to eat it for a couple of reasons. We think if there's no healthy planet, there's not going to be healthy humans, and we're devastating the oceans, and all they have to do is look at the data. The other part of it is we worry, although the data shows that people who eat fish, their brain is healthier, the data is not as strong as people think it is. Like you said, it's a little bit of a confirmation, but there's some association. So we say for people, in fact, in our populations, if they're starting and saying, go to fish first, and then if you want to go away from fish, that's your choice, but go to fish. But we worry a little bit about the fact that the difference in animals is we're concentrators. Because we have a liver, because we have organs, we have a lymphatic system that concentrates. And upward concentration, because as the animal eats other animals, they concentrate higher. In fish and oceans and even farmed fish, we check for some chemicals. We check for mercury and lead, not as consistently as people think we do, but we don't check for the other 30,000 chemicals that we've added into the oceans, not even close. Actually, we don't check at all. And we worry that might be having negative. Now, we might be doing confirmation bias on our side. We're looking for things to find negative in fish. So having said that, I throw the idea, and that's not solid science. That's... we call that, you know, we're extrapolating from data. So that's weak, and that's where it is. And we will never defend outside of the realm of science and the weight of science. When we raised our kids, we said, the problem in arguments and politics is not truth saying. Everybody's telling the truth in one way or another. Sometimes they're not, but it's the weight of the truth. When you over-exaggerate the truth, it's a fallacy. When you understate this truth, it's a fallacy. So we want to make sure that people get that this was extrapolation. And it's got a weak, it comes from a knowledgeable base, but still weak. So that's where we are with fish. We tell people, if you can settle down to fish, oh my goodness, you will have done so much good for your health if you've gone from processed meat, if you've gone from red meat, if you've gone from beef jerky, which I used to eat in Pittsburgh it's terrible. It's horrible. But especially the fact that it's full of salt as well, then you've done a lot of good. So that's a little complex, but that's reality of life. That's where we are.
Yeah, I really do appreciate that transparency. And I think, you know, as people of science, it's really important to have those sort of pragmatic decisions, even if, you know, you're being pulled in different directions. And I'll be honest, like, I'm probably on my journey towards 100% plant-based eating myself for reasons that also include animal welfare, because I recently got a puppy about a year ago, and she just reminds me of like a little lamb. Like, you know, she's just so cute, and, you know, she's so loving. And, you know, I never was a dog person. It was my partner who actually convinced me to get a puppy. And you know, I've never understood why people are just so drawn to their pets, and now I completely understand. Like, she sleeps in our bedroom, you know, take for walks all the time, give a treat, like everything, like I do for this dog.
I love
Ruby, so yeah, completely tangential talk. We adopted a dog that was in bad shape. We call him Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Like the Star Wars? Jedi Warrior? Yeah. Obi?
Yeah. Obi. Yeah. And he's a mix of Dalmatian and Basset Hound. So one black eye. And I'd like you. I'm not, you know, I'm very straight going, exercise the busy.
Yeah.
I literally, this is going to lose a lot of audience probably.
Hopefully
I
not.
Cried thinking that if I lose this dog,
yeah,
it
just
know.
Like yeah. breaks our heart just seeing that innocence in his face.
Totally, honestly, yeah. I feel exactly the same. Yeah. Like we sent her to puppy. This is really going off topic. We sent her to puppy daycare recently, and I remember just thinking, "Oh my god, I hope she's fine when she comes back." And we're watching her because they show her on Instagram.
Yes.
We're literally watching her. Like, oh my god, there she is, and she's playing and all that stuff. And like I never thought I'd be that person, but I am.
That's amazing.
You're a great interview. You took it. You did a Barbara Walters on us. You know, we're tearing up. We went from inflammation and neurotransmitters and
ApoE4 to tearing up on our puppies.
Yeah, but nonetheless, having said that, you're right about the fact that the data so far, like we always say, to the best of our knowledge today, and that's not that science is the only humble field out there because there's no. If the data changes, we change. At least with the science part, we change. At this point, the science on fish, at least clinical trials, show that people who consume fish. Oh, here's the thing. Instead of red meat, instead of other things, they do much better.
Yeah, yeah.
And as far as omega-3 fatty acids are concerned, because that's one thing that keeps coming back over and over again. Mm. You know, our systematic review showed that there are certain times in life, like as far as supplements are concerned, right? Especially for people who choose to be on a plant-based diet. There are, you know, it's not necessary for everyone. It's just a certain stage of life or a certain age group that it's very important. We found out, and it's being published, it's actually under review right now. We found out that for children who are growing and their brain grows massively during the first 5 years.
Actually.
During pre-birth, exactly. I should have started from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pre-birth, growth of a child in the first 5 years, pregnant women, lactating women, and people who are in their midlife or, you know, around mid-60s who may experience some mild cognitive impairment benefit the most. They might benefit from omega-3 fatty acid replacement. But for the rest of us, if we eat a wholesome diet that consists of seeds and nuts and extra virgin olive oil, sources of poly and monounsaturated fats, and a plant-based alpha-linolenic acid, then we actually do very well.
Okay, so you wouldn't suggest that people perhaps around the age of 45, 50 should think about omega-3 fatty acid supplementation in the form of algae oil or with high amounts of EPA and DHA? Or do you think we can achieve that through diet alone?
The diet alone, but here's the nuance. So the transfer or conversion from ALA to EPA to DHA is a funnel state, meaning that the enzyme that does that job actually does 2-3 jobs. For some reason, they didn't hire more people for that job. And it's that one guy, late night, very cheap. He's doing a lot of work. Now, he has to also operate the omega-6 pathway. And by the way, the omega-6 pathway is a dominant pathway. When we talk about omega-3, omega-6 pathway, they're both needed in the body. As we know, for the audience, omega-3 pathway, and I'm simplifying it profoundly, but it's anti-inflammatory, anti-coagulant, and others. Omega-6, pro-coagulant, pro-inflammatory. And by the way, we need both of those. I mean, if you're not coagulating, you'll be bleeding all over the place. So we need both. As it happens, because of stress, because of diet, because of lack of exercise, all these factors, and when we get to talking about stress, we develop a baseline higher inflammatory state as we get older. to cheat that system. And yes, we are cheating that system. I don't like the word biohacking. It's been used by, oh my goodness.
can't hack your way to health.
We plan our way towards more anti-inflammatory. You have to have more omega-3s. The ultimate goal is EPA, DHA, but ALA at very low level. But whenever people say low level conversion, they think that's bad. No, we get plenty. Even if it's at 8% conversion from ALA to, we get plenty. If we get two tablespoons of chia or flaxseed, we're good. But at the same time, to make sure that that conversion is done, lower your omega-6. But you're lowering your omega-6 not because of that conversion alone. Omega-6, as we get older, it becomes quite detrimental. Yeah. And our Western diet has gone 50-fold increase towards omega-6. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's been a revolution in the 20th century, it was not your iPhone. It was the fact that they were able to pack more calories in a small space with a profound amount of omega-6 in it. If we can reduce the omega-6, also give the liver a chance to do that job as well, which means less alcohol for multiple reasons. That three combination, actually, you are in a good direction. You don't have to do a lot of other things. But if you're worried, take an algae-based omega-3 or omega-3 source, and then you're fine. The three things that we worry about so far, to the best of our knowledge, as far as micronutrients are concerned, B12, omega-3, and then the third one, which came out of our work at Cedars-Sinai, we were the main PIs in this study. The retina is a continuation of the brain. So if you look at the retina, if you have these tools that can look at the retina at microscopic level, you can look at amyloid protein, which is the bad protein that accumulates with aging and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And when you gave people curcumin in high doses, and this paper actually was published this year, since we are now no longer in Cedars, our name went from first to the middle, as you know how that is. But it's okay. We're in the paper. The curcumin actually bound to the amyloid. And then when it binds, the body removes it. So we say add curcumin. All herbs and spices are great, but curcumin seems to have a special power. Add that with preparin, or pepper, which increases its bioavailability. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about B12 deficiency, first check it. And find out why, because normally you shouldn't have B12 deficiency unless you're taking some kind of antacids or something that's going on in your GI system. But if all that rules out, then take a B12. And by the way, it's not just for vegans. 40% of United States have B12 deficiency. And then the third one is omega-3. Optimize your diet and you'll be fine. But if you're worried, just take a supplement.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are definitely the ones that I recommend. I haven't come across that study this year, so I'm definitely going to be reading that. That sounds really, really interesting. And you know, I always get asked about curcumin, particularly from the perspective of it being a nootropic or something that's very good for the brain. I was going to ask you about that, actually, about what your perspective on nootropics are and whether that actually there's a space for that in clinical work. But I think if you can achieve that through diet, that's obviously the way to go. You mentioned alcohol. I did want to ask about alcohol. Again, my confirmation bias is I wouldn't mind having a glass of red wine every now and then. But the more I look at it, and I also look at it through the lens of society as well, and whether I should be recommending any amount of alcohol because of the other consequential effects of alcohol consumption, the fact is it's addictive. I'm coming around to the idea that we shouldn't be having any. Is that something that's in line with yourselves or...?
Absolutely. We've learned quite a bit about alcohol over the years. As you know, there was a time when it was recommended for brain health, but with more and more data, and especially with the nuanced information that we're receiving, we now understand that the alcohol component, forget about the resveratrol and all these other nutrients that are available in wine, the alcohol component causes a lot of damage. It's essentially putting our body in a major state of shock, especially the liver and the filters in our body. And we have recently found out that the amount of alcohol needed for brain is essentially zero. You don't need it. And the amount of resveratrol in wine that you would benefit from is, you have to drink a truckload of wine to get the amount of resveratrol that's good for the brain. And we also think that the studies that have shown benefit, they essentially, it probably might be because of the conviviality that is associated with alcohol. You're sitting with your friends and you're in with your tribe, and that's a very strong anxiolytic. And so that's probably not really taking into consideration and could be a confounding factor. But no, I agree with you. And the way we approach it in communities, because it could be a, you know, you lose a lot of friends if you say things like this. So we say, you know, if you've never drunk alcohol, don't start it for brain health. But if you do enjoy, you know, a glass, one here and there, never more than a glass a day, then I think that should be okay. Of course, in the context of a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah. Absolutely, always within that context, and you, the neuro lifestyle, which you alluded to before, you know, nutrition, exercise, unwinding, restoration, or optimizing. I think is again a very good sort of perspective, a lens to look at the brain. And I wanted to sort of close our conversation really talking about the unwind element and how that relates to not only brain health and creativity, but also our immune system and how we can support our innate immune system as well through our thoughts and other actions that can support unwinding and relaxing.
Before we get to that, I want to kind of attack some words.
Sure.
Two words that we want to make sure that people, if they don't mind, getting rid of from their vocabulary. One is moderation. Moderation is a word we use to get out of doing things. So, yeah. So, I mean, I used to eat 7 servings of processed meat a day in Pittsburgh. What is moderation for that person? 4 servings? Is that any better? The reason moderation doesn't work is because there's no measurable, quantifiable denominator. So why even use it? What we say, identify the optimal. Whether you believe us, and we look at our data, always look at the data, see if we're using any trick words like, you know, and of course, we are completely aligned. And if you believe us, then the optimal is as unprocessed, as whole food, as plant-centered as possible, and quantify that. And your job is to move towards that. Forget about moderation, this and that. How am I moving in a measurable way towards that? The benefit of that is not even about food. It's about you feeling a sense of control, which is bigger than food, which is bigger than next diet plan. So the second word we absolutely abhor, which we think is arrogant, and which is a vestige of the centuries of well, let's not make it too bombastic, is the word motivation.
Yeah.
Motivation, what is that? It feels like I'm supposed to get up in the morning motivated, rah-rah, arms up in the air, you know. No, throw that away. If you don't feel motivated, it's okay. What creates this feeling of movement forward is small incremental successes. Small measure, which connects to our previous term, doesn't it? Instead of moderation, small incremental successes. Once you create these small incremental successes that you check off, it creates a momentum that is way bigger than any motivation. So just those two words. In fact, out of this book, if you get anything besides her amazing recipes, is those two concepts of empowerment of behavior change. Instead of these bombastic words that feel like they're empowering, because I just listened to this guy talk and he was on stage and he was big guy and he was jumping around and I was so motivated. And then the next morning, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not like him. Why? And I feel bad.
Yeah.
No, small incremental successes. Now, stress. We actually divide stress into good stress and bad stress. And that's not a little play on word. It is important because your brain, there's a reason why evolution invested all this energy on this 3-pound organ. Why? Really? For me to just reproduce? I think there's more to it. It's information capture. Initially, the information capture was to get away from that tiger or bear. But civilization has given us more information capture tools. And if you're not information capturing throughout life, which is stressful sometimes, good stress, your brain actually decides that, oh, this energy investment at 50 years of age is not worth it. It actually withdraws and pulls back and shrinks. In fact, the number one factor that led to brain shrinkage was lack of cognitive challenge. Now, as much as people think Sudoku and crossword puzzles, which will at some point sue me, both of them, these companies, these
You've said a lot of bad things about Sudoku.
Yeah, the Sudoku, Crossword Industrial Complex will come after me. But those are great. Those are fine. But we did a meta-analysis in 2018. It was published looking at cognitive games and MCI patients, which is pre-dementia patients.
Mild cognitive impairment
patients. And what we found was three factors. Purpose, yes, in science there was a such a term, as, and I will define that purpose. Complexity and challenge. That's good stress. Bad stress is when you're doing activities that are not clear as far as purpose, doesn't have clear direction, don't have clear timelines, and they run on and on and on. And they're creating a feeling of tension. That comes to us from evolution, the fight or flight. At the core of our behavior, and I'm a behaviorist, I'm writing a book on behavior. At the core of our behavior is that fight or flight. As much as we think we're so complex and we've read thousands, no, fight or flight. If we can manage that, we've got control over our little universe. Fight or flight, sympathetic, parasympathetic, run everything. Now, that's one element. The fight or flight was needed because if the tiger was coming at you, you better focus all your energy away from reproduction, from your immune system, from your digestive system, from your growth system, and focus towards muscle, running, vasoconstriction so you don't bleed, and run. That's basically it. And if you look at it that way, you see that anything that creates that tension, short-term, it's good. In fact, we've seen that short-term tension, even that kind of tension.
We need it.
We need it. And actually, for survival. It creates resilience. But if that state of feeling persists and persists and persists, it creates profound damage. And in our Western world, or actually in the world in general, we have developed systems where that persistent, unsatisfied, incomplete discomfort, which creates the sympathetic undertone, persists, which lowers your immunity, lowers your growth, lowers your sex hormones, lowers your thyroid, lowers every system. How? Through what we define as the limbic, hypothalamic, pituitary axis, as well as the sympathetic. Now, this is cool. Every emotion you feel is translated in your limbic system and frontal lobe to say good or bad. If it's good, it sends a different information to your hypothalamus, which sends the different information to your pituitary. Now, pituitary is hormone central. The tip of your little pinky, that's how big it is. But that little organ has your control of your growth hormone, thyroid, insulin, sexual function, your indirectly through your adrenal, your immune system, everything is controlled there. So your everyday emotions continually affect your hormonal system, including your immune system. If you have good feeling, it sends a different information to your hypothalamus and pituitary, which actually stabilizes all that. So two pathways, sympathetic, parasympathetic, we call them autonomic, and the limbic, hypothalamic, pituitary, all coming from your emotions. Now, that's a little daunting because as soon as I say that, people say, even if they don't say it verbally, they feel it. I have no control over that. This is too complicated. Or the next thing is I'm going to meditate and do mindfulness, which is very important. But there's a little more thing to this. We talk about, and in the book we talk about this, how systematically break this down under your control. SMART goals. Spend some time writing your good stresses specifically and measurably. And we're not used to this. You'll get better and better at this. And your good stresses specifically and measurably. And work towards reducing, eliminating, and delegating the bad stressors over time. Increasing, empowering, and tooling the good stressors. And that's not a pill you take and the next hour you feel better. That's a tool you develop that makes you permanently better and better and better and better over 6 months. But that's powerful because by doing that, you actually take control of something that's not been controlled before, your autonomic system. You take control of something that's never been even talked about, which is your limbic, hypothalamic, pituitary system. But in a functional way with writing, for example, I don't like my job is not specific. We drive to Loma Linda twice a day, 2 hours, twice a week, 2 hours, one way or the other. That's terrible. But we do other things in Loma Linda, which is this clinical trial, this thing, and seeing patients. Those are good. So how do I reduce this over time? And we do telemedicine now. And how do we increase the good ones where we do public speaking and talk and increase that? And our life, which is pretty full, yeah, now is a little more controlled, less anxiety, less stress, less inflammation. Yes, those emotions have more profound effect. And that's how you get control over good and bad stress. And by the way, good stress is things like learning a new musical instrument, learning how to dance. For some of us, it can be more stressful, bad stress to do learn how to dance, but yeah, we will leave that alone.
Yeah, we won't say who.
We won't say who. Learning to play cards with friends.
Yeah.
Learning a new language, running a team, book clubs. Those are taking classes, you know. Those are good stressors that push your brain, but also are the biggest factor for connections of the neurons. Sorry, one last point on that. Here is a power. 87 billion neurons. Each of them can make two connections or 30,000 connections. And how do we make the connections? Exercise and good stress. That's power. That's control.
That is power. I mean, I love the way that you've mixed in sort of the logical engineering pathways of the brain and, you know, modeled that on the creativity element as well and why that's so important. And I look at you both, and obviously you're both very advanced in your scientific thinking, but there's a lovely blend of like the culinary creativity there and the emotional side as well as the science across you both. So I think it's just a wonderful team that you've got, and the book is incredible as well. So I just thought I'd take this moment to thank you both for your work, and I can't wait to support you in all your future endeavors.
We love everything you do, everything you stand for, your work, your food, my goodness, and just being connected with you. It's just a joy. I'm looking forward to speaking with you more, hopefully in the future, and coming and probably cooking together.
And definitely, we don't have just passing conversations.
No.
We have families.
You're family now.
Oh, that's so lovely.
No, we mean it. That's good and bad.
I appreciate that.
we might be annoying
now.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, that's great. Honestly, I could have chatted to you guys for so much longer. I've got so many other elements and things that I didn't even ask about, but you know, we'll save that for another time. And I didn't realize that you're writing another book as well. That's amazing. I don't know where you get the time, you guys.
So much to say, so much to converse about.
It's a
beautiful,
yeah,
life.
I really hope you enjoyed that with Dr. Dean and Dr. Aisha Shirzai. They are just such a unique combination, and I loved chatting to them. To summarize our conversation, plant-forward diets are fantastic through the perspective of not just brain health, but also vascular disease, cardiovascular disease, and mood as well. You've learned how creativity has a bi-directional effect on the brain, and this is not just about Sudoku or crosswords. While you don't need to eat a ton of fat to support your brain, but quality fats are essential for your brain, and specifically when it comes to omega-3 fatty acids. You've also learned about the other lifestyle interventions that support brain health. Please do go check out their book. It is a fantastic resource full of all the different things that we've talked about today. It's called The 30-Day Alzheimer's Solution, and you will find all the links to the books and their work on the show notes on the podcast page of thedoctorskitchen.com. See you here next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.